I have a handout. Yeah. Testing one, too. I have a handout, but it's also, it really doesn't flow directly, so I'm going to pass it out at the end. Okay? You'll have that for a review. Okay? Let me review, speaking of review, let me review what we talked about last time. It's very important to get those foundations because it'll carry us, well, certainly it'll carry us for this week and next, but also I think it's a good template to keep in mind always when you're thinking about how the whole system of mitzvahs works, to the best of understanding. Rav Berkowitz says that just as there is a realm of natural science that is true and we feel it, it's real in the physical world, there's a parallel system in the spiritual realm as well, and that the understanding of that is that we act in the physical world. Similarly, there are acts that are metaphysical in nature. The acts themselves are physical, or if they're thoughts, they're not physical, but they're real thoughts, tangible, at least to us they are. Speech is real, and they affect us, our souls, in a metaphysical way. So we talked about last time about all different types of laws, but different types of mitzvahs, but all of them dealt with Torah laws derived from Torah, deraisa, okay, Torah-itic, as a scientist would say, okay, Torah-itic. Okay, today I'm going to talk about derabbanan, rabbinic law. Okay, how does that fit into the science? And that will lead us to the natural question of the next step, which is customs, which we'll very unlikely cover tonight. Probably it'll be next time. But basically, if we're to understand that God's laws are a science, then how is it that rabbis' laws affect that science? Okay, let me put it this way. There's a science in the natural world that God put together. We don't see that people, they confound a type of equation that describes the science, but people don't make up new laws, right? That don't already exist. In other words, when Einstein sort of disproved Newton, Newton disproved Aristotle, it wasn't that they were creating something new, they were describing something that was already there. Okay? That's not true with derabbanan. So the rabbis are actually creating something that's new. So how do we understand that and fitting into a science? So first of all, although it doesn't really answer the question, but it's important to understand that rabbinical law is sanctioned by the Torah. It says in and you'll get it in your notes, so don't busy writing it down, but it says in Deuteronomy and Devarim, do not stray from what they tell you to the left or to the right. Okay? And it's specifically referring to the Sanhedrin, but it's understood to mean that in every generation, the leading rabbinical figures, whomever they may be, they will do interpreting, they will do expanding as necessary for the Klal Yisrael. But it really doesn't answer the question. The question is, how does this work into a science? We've given them permission now, perhaps, but we haven't answered the question. In other words, why didn't God just say so? In other words, if God, who is all-knowing and is beyond the scope of time, even if you were to tell us that things would change over time, and they have, well, God knows that. And so couldn't he have figured out a way to put into his Torah, into the written Torah, or even the oral Torah, but it's God-given, what the rules are and what the rules shall be when certain things change? And for example, we know that there are Torah laws from when a temple exists and Torah laws when the temple doesn't exist. So there are already Torah laws we have under varying circumstances. There are Torah laws from when we're in Eretz Israel, and there are Torah laws when we're not in Eretz Israel. There are Torah laws when the majority of Jews are living in Eretz Israel, and when they're not. There are obviously Torah laws for men and Torah laws for women. There are Torah laws for Kohanim and Levim. There are Torah laws that affect different people, different times, different circumstances. Couldn't God have put in what would ultimately become rabbinical laws? Couldn't he have done that himself? Okay. So, in a way to understand that, it's useful, although it's not obviously a not perfect parallel, to look at the Constitution of the United States. I'm not saying this as necessarily the best document I'm not positing one way or the other that it's the best or not the best document of how society should live, but it exists, and we live in this country, so it's a good model to look at. It's been around for 200 years, and the founding fathers, we know that they were great men with good vision, but they certainly could not have imagined all the changes that would occur over the 200-year period, or plus, that has ensued. What they did know, though, that they were human, okay, and they knew that they had human limitations, and they knew that there would be changes over time. I think their hope was that this document and the country that they were founding would succeed and would last a long time. But they knew that, if that were the case, they knew that there would be substantial changes in society. But their greatness, therefore, was that they put into the system a provisions for change, which we call amendments. So it would seem, really, and it isn't true, but it seems that Torah has left something open-ended, that there's room for change, that there's room for more law. Now, really, it doesn't make sense, because the founders of the United States were people. And even though they're great people, they're still people. And people are fallible, number one, and people don't know the future. But this is God we're talking about. He doesn't have human limitations. So again, the question comes back, why didn't he include every commandment? So we need to look at, what is this commandment? The commandment, again, the Torah is a commandment, do not stray from what they tell you. Right, that's a Torah-level commandment. So it's a little tricky, because there's a commandment, which is a Torah commandment, don't stray from what they say. What is that? That is the that is a commandment, a requirement of the rabbis to manufacture laws, and that we should not go away from those laws. Right. What is the commandment in itself? What's a specific law of nature? Meaning that if you break this law, what aspect of our soul is damaged? So it's not the act itself, it's that we're not listening to the rabbis. The natural law, then, is listen to the rabbis when they create law. That's the natural law. Okay. So, for example, lighting Hanukkah candles, that's a positive commandment. It's a rabbinical commandment. It must be. Hanukkah came well after the Torah was closed, right? Anything that came after, by definition, is post-Torah, and so therefore it can't be Torahitic. So lighting, Hanukkah candles, you're fulfilling the mitzvah. What is the mitzvah? Lighting Hanukkah candles. Where did that mitzvah come from? The rabbis created it. De novo. Okay? They felt that it would be useful. We'll talk about the specifics, but they felt that that would be something that we would need to do, that we'd benefit from. What aspect, if we don't light Hanukkah candles, okay, so we have not done a positive commandment, but it's a rabbinical commandment, so what part of the soul suffers? We didn't listen to the rabbis. Not that we didn't light candles. Okay? Okay. So, with that in mind, we can now go into the two different types, the two major types of rabbinical law.
Are there punishments then for breaking rabbinical commandments?
Yeah. Yeah.
There are punishments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But is it a punishment on not doing, on don't stray right?
That's
or
right.
Left?
That's
fine.
Exactly
so
right.
Not a punishment on... So it's not a punishment on not... Oh, wait. There's no punishment on a matasa anyway, is there?
There is, not the same thing.
There
yeah, there is. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But it's a different punishment. So the two different types of derabbanans are... And they're very different from one another. And people get confused, but it is confusing at first. One is offense, basically. Okay, that goes by different names. We're going to give it a different name later on, but the easy way to understand it is it's offense. It's a siag, which in Hebrew, offense. The Torah commands it itself. It says, Ushmartem es mishmarti. Literally, you should guard my guarding. Right, and the Talmud interprets this as you should put fences around the fences, or put a fence around my fence. Okay. Mishneh Avos, right? It tells you asu siag l'Torah. You should make a fence for the Torah. So, I'll give an example, okay, and there's actually many examples, but a good example is, in the handout that I made for you, there's other examples which I think are useful. The Torah commands. Hi, Nate. The Torah commands us right? Don't, and God says, don't eat meat and milk together. Don't cook meat and milk, I'm sorry. Don't cook meat and milk together. And then if you do, or if someone else does, don't eat them together. So it's beef bourguignon, where they have the beef and the cream sauce all over it, whatever it is. I don't know what that is. Okay, I don't know. It's noodles and beef and, or, not the, what that beef, that's that famous Greek dish that everyone, I love.
Moussaka.
Right, of course. But this the way to make it, I mean, the way it's made, if you look, open up any recipes with meat and milk. Okay, so that is a Torahitic iser, right? You can't do that, okay? And there's actually three aspects, but one, right? You know them, I think. One, you can't make them, you can't cook them, even if it's not for you. You can't eat them together, even if someone else made them, even a non-Jew made them, doesn't really matter. And you can't gain benefit somehow. It's, what is the specific iser on a Torah-level commandment then? There are three parts, but look, I'm focusing on eating, for example, is having a dish with a meat component and a milk component mixed, or, you know, so that you can put it in your mouth at the same time. That's the iser d'oraisa. Okay. The rabbis extended it a couple of ways, right? They, number one, they said that they'd expanded meat to include chicken, fowl. Okay, so that's one. That's not part of the Torah commandment. And they expanded together as having them at the same meal. So, for example, having a hamburger and a glass of milk is not an iser d'oraisa, right? Because you're not eating them together. They're not the same dish, right? And forget about it. Obviously, they weren't cooked together because they're not the same dish, right? So that would be a rabbinical of avera, even though you're having meat, beef, you know, and milk, right? So, but it's not the same dish. So therefore, it's a derabbanan. We'll later on we'll talk about the 6 hours business, but let's leave it at that for now. Okay, so the rabbis are not saying that this is what God said. They're not even saying this is what God intended. They're saying we want you to be so conscious of how severe this is. We're going to make a fence around that. It's like this. It's very easy. The fence idea is a very good one. Here is a cliff, and there's a 500-foot drop into the ocean with rocks. Okay. We're very scared that you know, to let you walk right up to it and look over, we're a little nervous, you know, for you. We care about you, right? So we're going to put a fence up here. In fact, we're going to put it here, you know, and maybe even two fences. That's stretched. That's a whole, you know, the Talmud says you don't make a gezerah on a gezerah, so leave that for them. But I mean, we're going to put some sort of protective barrier so that, you know, I can't even get close. Right? Now, we're not saying natural law is that if you step here, you're going to die. No, we're not saying that. But we're saying that this is important enough that we're going to be very cautious. Okay, and that's exactly what the rabbis did in the spiritual realm. They recognize that it might be easy under certain circumstances to mess up. You know, on the chicken example, there are times, not always and not usually, but there are times when chicken is prepared in a certain way, ground chicken perhaps, dark meat chicken, maybe turkey, that's going to look like beef, right? And so if you make a dish with it and someone sees that and go, oh, this is okay, someone is going to say, I guess it's okay, right? Or the dishes are next to each other, that's an easy stretch. If I have the hamburger here and the meat here and it's in the mouth at the same time, what's the difference between that and having it in the same dish? So if these are protective fences, and the rabbis are telling us, or they're telling us to keep in mind, this over this is death is certain, so we don't want that. So therefore, we're going to help you, we're going to help everybody by putting up a fence. So our soul, the way to understand the mitzvah is the soul needs the fence. Okay, that soul, the rabbis who we entrust, especially the people who really made most of these, as we'll talk about in a moment. They're concerned about our souls. They're concerned about the survival of the Jewish people, but also the individual's soul. So they recognize that the soul needs this fence to survive. So the commandment, therefore, is: you, the Jewish people, you build yourself fences around the averas, around the mitzvahs, in order to remind yourself of the severity of trespassing that which is beyond, and that's called gezerah. Okay, that's the word, is the gozer, to be gozer something, to make a gezerah, a decree literally, but that's what it's referring to always. Now, it's important to recognize also that the quality of the fence has to be different than the quality of the thing itself you're protecting. If there were no difference between the fence and the thing itself, if God were to tell us the fence, in other words, the question we had before is why couldn't God have developed, somehow told us through the Torah, through the oral Torah, all the various situations that we would encounter, then therefore have built-in fences, okay? What the answer is, then it would be the same thing as that which is forbidden in the first place. That which is forbidden is godly, okay? The fence is, by what we're defining here, is not godly. It's rabbinical, knowingly rabbinical, okay? If both were godly, there would be no difference between one and two. God says, don't go here. In fact, you know what? Don't even go here. Well, I can't go here because God said so. And what's the difference, right? I can't go here because God said so. Here, the rabbis are helping me so I don't stumble and fall. Okay? So I therefore understand that my soul needs this protective barrier, and this is qualitatively different than what goes on over here. This is death. This is protection. It's a demilitarized zone. it's a barrier so that I don't slip into something very, very dangerous. Okay? And that's how we understand. That's gezeira, or siag, fence, etc. Okay. The other one, and you may think of, immediately come to mind, there's a lot of commandments, if you look at the Torah, that are left rather vague. I may be bold to say so, but it seems like intentionally vague. I'm not talking about examples like tefillin, which are vague, but they're not vague in the Torah Shebaal Peh. I'm talking about you can't find it. You know, there's nowhere in the Sora prior to when the rabbis enacted the definitions that there were any definitions for. And I'll give you a few examples here, okay? Number one, prayer. Okay? We know we're supposed to pray.
Where okay. is that in the Torah that you're supposed to pray?
You know, I was thinking about that. I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question. Let me find
Maybe,
out.
I'm really totally guessing.
Okay.
Is there a commandment? I don't even know if it's in the Torah, if it's after Yosha. For the Kohen to sound the shofar out when they go into...
Yes, there is, but I don't think that's where we learn our prayer. It may be we learn our prayer from... We know we do vidui. That's a verbal. So, I mean, we know we do karbonos, and we're supposed to say something on the karbon. So I want to say that maybe it has to do with that, but I'm not sure. Okay. So I will... Lunetta will get back to you on that. Okay. When we pray, how we pray, it's not discussed. Charity. Tzedakah. How much? Not there.
But doesn't it say, it brings up tithes and it brings up right. years you're supposed to give to the poor.
Very good. Definitely supposed to give to the poor. There's a definitely commandment, deraisa, to give to the poor.
But Meister's there. I mean,
Meister, it's called an asmachta. It's a hint. When the rabbis came, and the rabbis actually made the rules of how much and what's too much. Okay, they use the expression from, was it last week's Parsha, right? This last week's Parsha, when the end of the battle of the five kings versus four kings, so Avram Avinu says, is that right? Or is it Yaakov Avinu? He says he's Maser Esakol. He gives a tenth of everything. So I think that's the source that the rabbis used, but it's not, for example, in the Sefer Achinuch, on the Rambam, anybody who enumerates the mitzvahs, you don't see that they point to any place here in Genesis where they talk about how much tzedakah to give.
Now, wait a minute.
Nope.
The Devarim, though, help me out. It talks about, the Meister of the...
Oh, the animals.
Yeretz Levim, and then...
The Meister Behema. There's Meister Behemoth.
A certain year it's for Ani and a certain year it's for
Yehudi. Okay, okay. For
but
sure.
Is that Meister? Am I totally mixing that up?
No, that's very good. You give Truma to the Kohanim. Right. That's about a 50th or a 60th or a 40th. And then you give Meister to the Levium. Mm-hmm. All right, then there's Meister Shani / Meister Oni, right?
Right.
Meister Shani, Meister Rishon, that the 10th that you give to the Levi, that's only of produce. And so, and that's also true of also Meister Ani and Meister, The Meister Sheni, you actually eat it yourself. You don't give it to anybody. You just put it aside to eat it in Yerushalayim. Meister Ani, which happens 2 out of the 7 years, then 3rd and 6th year, right? So on those years, that's a tenth of your produce. Mm-hmm. It's not your tenth of your gain, not tenth of your income, not your tenth of your wealth. And you know, people, for example, who are ranchers, you know, who actually, you know, or milkmen. Okay, people have cows, and their income is based on milk. They have very little meister to give. Right? So that is different. And again, those are called asmachtas. Those are hints from somech to lean on, to depend on something. Okay, so the rabbis depended on little aspects of the Torah. Similarly, when we pray. It says the Gemara, there's a long discussion about where do we learn that we're supposed to have 3 tefillos a day, and there's a machlokus. One says we learn that from karbonis. There's the tamidim, the tamid shel boker, and the tamid shel ben arbaim, the morning tamid, and the afternoon tamid, that's shachris and mincha. And then overnight, the ashes burn all night long, and they're supposed to, and whatever's left at the end of the day, they're removed and start the day over again. Right? So those, and then also the musaf, we learn out from musaf, and that's obvious, right? Because it's called musaf. Right? So, but that's again, it's an asmachta. The Torah never said pray according to these karbanas, and the tamid had nothing to do with prayer. For example, in and of itself, people didn't gather during the tamid and say anything, so there was nothing associated with the tamid, the carbon tamid, that would resemble a prayer service.
So
those are asmachtas.
And the Meister Sheni that we talked about?
It's also an asmachta, because remember, Meister Sheni is only, well, not Meister Sheni, Meister Rishon, Meister Levi, the Meister Levium, right? Because Meister Sheni is only certain years. We don't have tzedakah only certain years.
Oh.
Right, and that's one. Meister Ani is 2 out of the 7. Meister Rishon, first we get to the Levi. So, I mean, again, that you can say that would be maybe a source for giving a tenth, because that's every year. But again, it's number one, it's only to Levium, that's not true of tzedakah, number one. Number two, it's produce only. Not just the gift has to be produce, but the tenth of what? The tenth of your produce. And sure, we were in an agrarian society, but not everybody was a farmer. Like I said, there were milk people and whatever, construction people who made their income by helping build. Right? Or a tailor, you know, or a shoemaker, whatever else they had. These people had no, maybe they're the poor people, I don't know. But they would still have the mitzvah of tzedakah, but they wouldn't have anything to give as far as meister is concerned. There's also meister behemah, someone who had a lot of animals. Every tenth animal had to be brought as a carbon. But that's as a carbon, and then, you know, so that's not, that's, I think it goes to the Kohanim, I'm not sure. I think it goes to the Kohanim. So maybe you learn that from that as well. Okay, so those are places from which we learn out, but there's no explicit rules for what we're talking about here. Another one, and here there's no explicit rules at all, and that's tznius, the dignity in dress, and there's no guidelines whatsoever. So from where does a Jew go for guidelines? So why aren't there guidelines? Well, over the generations, what the Torah had intended is that, I wrote it down here, but I remember this thought, that what the Torah intended is everybody should know the mitzvah well, everybody should know themselves well, and be beautifully and perfectly objective, and recognize what it is they have to do. You know, given all tzedakah, given all the money that I have, how much I can afford to give, I know how much people need it right now, maybe it's a particularly bad year, you know, my connection with the Almighty, that's all, and it should all be objective. Tefillah. You know, am I an emotional person who likes to spill out my heart? Maybe someone, the next guy isn't. Maybe just like he does. You know, there are people who are emotional and people who are not emotional. People who are verbal, people who are not verbal. People who cry easily, people who don't cry easily. So everyone's supposed to know themselves well enough to understand exactly how much, and it sounds almost wild to us because we live in this world of the rabbis told us what to do. But this is what the Torah evidently intended. Because there were no guidelines, right? And unfortunately, over the generations, people swayed one way or the other. I'll show you how it happened both ways. I think you may have learned. Or if you didn't, you'll know now. Not everyone made use of their capabilities. Because sometimes people, myself certainly included, but sometimes people make decisions on factors other than our objective. And we sometimes do things like what we feel like doing now, as opposed to what we understand God wants me to do. Okay, so the rabbis were concerned about us, again, and so they made up what's called takana, which is as opposed to gezeira. This is the other rabbinical, the type of rabbinical rule. Okay. A takana is a canonized definition, a definition where none existed before. Okay. So, for example, tzedakah. What's the Torah definition of tzedakah? None, other than don't be stingy and don't be reckless. Okay, that's it. So the rabbis recognized that the first takana that came along is don't give more than 20%. Because what happened was they saw that Jews were so generous and so sincerely God-believing, they figured, you know, these poor Jews are suffering. I'll give everything I have. I'll give 90% of what I have. And God's been great to me so far. He will be good to me. And the people will believe that. And unfortunately, the next day you have two poor Jews. You have the old Jew, poor Jew, and the new poor Jew. You know, and the rabbi said, we can't do this because you're joining the group of poor. We can't do that. So they set a maximum of 20%. The Chafetz Chaim has a sefer, not called the Chafetz Chaim, another name, Avas Yisrael, in which he actually gives parameters for tzedakah. And in it he says, the very, very wealthy people, there are times when they can give more than 20%. Well, you think about it, if you make $1 billion a year, you know, you can probably afford to give $300 million away, and you still have to struggle on $700 million that's left. You know, so, as an example. Alright, so, but then ultimately, there's also the other side of the coin where people became stingy, or some people were stingy, so they said no less than 10%. Alright, so, as I mentioned to you, as we talked about a little bit already, the rabbis didn't come and make up these rules based on nothing. They found hints in the Torah, and that's what we call asmachta. They found, you know, what is this like? And the tzedakah one is an example. This is like the Jews have to give a tenth of this and a tenth of this and a portion of that. And so let's use those as an example. Those use as a model. Prayer. Right? So, right, they defined it 3 times a day. They gave us a script. Right? This is a script that we use. In fact, it's only been changed once, right? With a 19th, the Shemona Esrei. There's 19, even though we still call it Shemona Esrei. So who are these rabbis? And who can just come along? Can anybody just come along and say, I have a new takana for you? Some takanas seem like they come out of nowhere, you know, when there's something that's so earthy we haven't had. They come very infrequently. But, for example, Hanukkah and Purim are takanas. They're brand new holidays. There's several takanas that Rabbeinu Gershon made about 1,000 years ago, a little more than 1,000 years ago. He was before Rashi, and he was called Rabbeinu Gershon Me'or Hagalus, the light of the Golus. Probably know some of them, but several things he made. That one is a man should not have more than one wife. That's where that came from. A woman has to accept a get. In fact, not only that, but must accept a get. Before that, she didn't have to. The Torah law, for example, is that a woman can be divorced against her will. Rabbeinu Gershon came along in the 900s, I forgot the exact year, but in 900-something, and made a takana that's not the case anymore, that henceforth women have to accept it. Also, not to open up other people's mail. That was from him. So he made a series of these takanas that are, you know, we take for granted. And sometimes it's interesting, takanas these days are not universally accepted, which we'll get to, by the way. We're going to get to it. But for example, you may have heard, there was a takana fairly recently, about 2 years ago or so, in Lakewood, that's intended for all of Klal Yisrael, of internet. You know, of how internet should be used, and whether it should be used in the home, whether it should just be used in business, and also and so forth. It's not been universally... Hi, are you here for this class?
I was supposed to be, but I was in an interview and I couldn't escape. Oh, I'm so sorry.
No problem.
Oh, you're right. I thought you were in an interview.
I was in an interview. I'm so sorry.
Oh, you're so glad to
I'm
see you.
I'm so sorry. I feel so guilty for
That's
being
not a problem.
Late.
That's not a problem. It's not a problem. How do we catch her out?
Let's see. And I was... Hi, I'm Aura.
Aura, hi. Manny, how are you? Okay, you know each other, I guess. Yeah. You okay? Catch your breath. Want some water?
Okay, thanks.
Let me see if I can recap, okay? I'll have you write down your name and information there, but... let me go on, actually, because we're right in the middle of something,
no problem,
and then I'll recap,
don't let
okay?
Me stop whatever's going on.
Okay. So again, so who are the rabbis, right? Can anybody just do this? So historically, some of them are very, very old. Some were actually created by Moshe Rabbeinu, Mei Takanos, that were not Torahitic. You'd think that they would be, but they're not. As an example, I'm almost certain it was him that said that the Torah must be read publicly on Shabbos, Mondays, and Thursdays. That's a takana of Moshe Rabbeinu. He didn't say God told me this. You know, when it was part of the Masorah that he gave over, this was his own creation. Because if the Jews went more than 3 days without Torah, you know, they would forget things. So this is their way to constantly one of the many ways that they're supposed to review. Okay, there are some from David HaMelech. There are some from Shlomo HaMelech. The Eruv came from Shlomo HaMelech. Tilas Yadayim came from Shlomo HaMelech. There wasn't an Atilas Yadayim, other than the Kohanim, to be pure when they did their service. See, they always get it from somewhere. Okay, that's the end of the Smachta. But for that everybody should, we don't pure, you know, we don't become Tahor. First of all, we don't have to be Tahor to eat food, because the food is not Truma. It's not, right, it's not Truma. What would you call
Truma? The food we set aside even.
Truma is the food that Kohanim eat. Okay, you know about that? No. Okay. Right. So they have to wash their hands literally because of their, you know, there's issues of tuma tahara. All right. We don't. Nobody does now. But even Yisraelim, even in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, didn't have to in order to eat their food because they were eating whole. There wasn't Kodesh. They weren't eating sacrificial food. When you eat sacrificial food, you have to have a certain degree. Obviously, you're eating. You know, this is holy food, right? If you're eating your meat at home in a barbecue, it's not holy food. This is food, right? So, this is it. One of the takanas was Shlomo HaMelech. We're talking about takanas and rabbinicals, and we'll explain why in a moment. The vast majority, however, were created by a group of people called the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, literally the men of the Great Assembly, right? And these people were either prophets or had Ruach HaKodesh, all of them. There were a good 8 to 10 we know of who are prophets for the ages. You know, we're talking about Mordechai, we're talking about... Hi.
Hi, excuse me. I wanted to catch a minion for Myra.
It's supposed to be a 9 o'clock minion. I'm not sure it's here or next door. I don't know that there's one before that.
Okay.
There's an 8:55 at Beth Jacob, so it's got 5 minutes earlier.
Yeah, that's all right. I can stick around.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Okay. Having said all this, actually, you know what? I'm going to go and review now. And I'll come and give you the punchline a little later. Just a moment, okay? What we had talked about is kind of a continuation of something we had mentioned last week. We started last week by saying that our understanding of mitzvos in general is that they're part of a natural law. But instead of natural law of the physical world, these are natural laws of the spiritual world. There are natural laws of the physical world that we're very familiar with, and even though you can be the greatest Baal Emunah and Baal Bitachon that ever was, but if you thought it was too cold in here and you'd like the temperature to get a little warmer, you'd get up and turn the air conditioner on or off or close
cold?
The door.
I'm sorry.
Huh?
Are you cold? Would you like to?
No, that wasn't the hint.
Okay. Just wondering.
Okay. Or if it was too dark, you know. In other words, you don't just pray to God. No one does this. No one does. Even people at a very high madriga. Did you see Rabbi Hillel when he was here, by the way? No? You're here? Okay. The Rabbi Hillel came from Eretz Yisrael recently, and he spoke. He spoke at the school. But he also spoke a number of different places. And he's a big Kabbalist and highly respected. At any rate, people, when they want things done in the natural world, they do something about it physically. Similarly, there's no just, you know, good thoughts and earnest belief. It doesn't count for a whole lot. Similarly, in the spiritual realm, one has to feed the soul. One has to do things in order for the soul to flourish, or not to do things in order for the soul not to suffer. And those are called mitzvahs. We talked last week about different types of Torah-edic mitzvahs, deraisa mitzvahs. There are mishpatim, there are chukim, and then there's other things which we call mitzvos themselves, which are things like prayer, which are obviously, or shaking a lulav, which are obviously religious. They clearly are religious. So we noted that for chukim, these are black and white issues. There's no principle behind them. There may be that's what we call timing of mitzvahs. There's like reasons that people like Hirsch and the Chinuch have discussed as people throughout the eras who have actually tried to help us understand side reasons for the mitzvahs. But those they never said these are the reasons you do the mitzvahs. The reason you do the mitzvahs is that God commanded you to do the mitzvahs. For chukim, the usual translation is that we don't understand. There's no logical explanation for these mitzvahs. This food is kosher. This food is not kosher. Why? Well, I can tell you 100 reasons why. This is like this. This is like that. That's all very well and good. But God said this is kosher and this is not kosher. And even if I can disprove your reason, it doesn't really matter. This is still kosher and this is not kosher. And it doesn't matter if it's a Thursday or a Wednesday. It doesn't matter if it's a leap year. It doesn't matter if I feel good about it or if I don't feel good about it. If I have an appetite, none of the things matter. You know, this food is kosher and this food is not kosher, and that's the way it is, right? That's a chok. There's no ifs, ands, buts, or others. There's really no emotional component to a chok. You know, if I eat a cheeseburger and I feel guilty about it, it doesn't matter. I still ate a cheeseburger. Okay? Okay. Mishpat doesn't work that way. Because mishpat, the act itself, doesn't define whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Okay? The same act can be positive, it can be negative, depending on circumstances. The example we gave last week, the Gemara has a story of a man who put his father to work in his factory, ordering him to work in his factory, doing back-breaking work. The Gemara said he did. This is an example of kibud avim. Why? Because the Romans, as a result of the fact that his father now was working, did not enlist him into the army, and they were going to otherwise. So he saved his father from going into the army, which probably meant death. Okay, so obviously that, you know, and normally you would not think of that, but that obviously it depends on the circumstances. And there are many examples like that. So those are mishpatim. We mentioned that the mitzvos, there is an act, and the act is important. But let's say we daven, and during the entire tefillah, we don't think for one moment what we just said, what we were saying at all. We just like, our mind is on the sale that's coming up, and we have to quickly figure out what's the best way to get there, and how am I going to do this when I got to pick up the kids, and how am I going to do that when I have this appointment, and oh, I'm done, 3 steps back, look at that, oh great, I'm done already, I can actually start the rest of my day. What did we do? Nothing. We didn't do anything. We're yotze only from the standpoint of we don't have to do it again, but we get absolutely no reward from that. So we don't get punished, but we don't get any reward. We got a big zero for that. Might as well have done nothing. Okay. So, that's a mitzvah. There's an emotional component that has to accompany something, you know, either kavana or feeling or something. Okay? That catch up from yesterday? I know there's lots of details I'm leaving out, but, you know, wanted to get everything in. Today what we talked about are the next level, which is, that's all deraisa. All that is Torah-idic Torah laws. God wrote the Torah. God gave the Torah to Moshe. Moshe wrote it down. How about rabbinical laws? God never wrote rabbinical laws. So we discussed to some extent why that was the case. And the best way to understand that is from the standpoint of a gezeira. There's two types of rabbinical laws as gezeiras, and there are takana. A gezeira is like a fence. Okay? God says, don't cook meat and milk together, and if you do accidentally, don't eat it. Or if someone else does, still, don't eat it. Right? Musaka, right? So if you had musaka, real musaka, don't eat it, right? Even if it's kosher meat and kosher cheese. It's kosher. Don't eat it. Okay? The rabbis came along and said, even if it's the same meal, but not cooked together. So you have a hamburger and a glass of milk. They're not cooked together. They're not in the same dish. Right? But the rabbi said, don't eat them at the same meal. Okay? They never said God meant to say this. They never said God said this. They said this is offense, and you, your soul, needs this. Where do they came up with this? There's a pasuk that says, you shall listen to them, you shall not stray from their words, left or right. That's in Devarim. Okay? And therefore, our understanding is that our soul needs this not straying business. Okay? Therefore, our soul needs gezeiros. It needs offense. Because that increases our respect for that which is on the other side of the fence. Similarly to any example of a fence which is there protecting you from danger. You know, there are wild buffaloes running on the other side and you don't want to be there. Good to have a fence. The other type of rabbinical law is takana. A takana is from tikkun, same shorash as Hashem Hebrew?
I don't know. Okay. I can't answer that.
Okay. It's
I understand a lot, but...
Good. Well, tikkun is to repair, a reparation, to repair, to fix something. Okay? Lasakein is to fix something. Okay? So, a takana is repairing something. But it's not really repairing. Nothing wrong with the Torah. Many parts of the Torah, and you may have noticed this, I'm not sure, you may have noticed, many parts of the Torah are left rather vague and open-ended. And you can look high and low in the Torah itself. You won't find it. You may find hints to it, but they're not addressing this specific issue. So the examples we gave are tzedakah, charity, prayer, frequency, for example, or what you say. You know, that's not in there. And the other one, otznius, of modesty and dress and appearance. So what does that mean? To what extent? Do we walk around with masks and only our eyes showing? You know, no. Right? Like other people do. Or, no, I'm not saying we should do that. But she's running away. She's getting scared.
I'm
telling
her. I'm going to shut the door.
Okay.
Is that okay? Would that technically be okay to shut the door?
Is it locked or not locked?
It's not locked.
So people come in. Right? That's okay. It's okay. Even better. Okay. Okay. So the rabbis came along, and after a little while, the idea was that every Jew should know himself, know his strengths, know his abilities, know what was necessary, know what the Torah said, and come to a conclusion of what should be done now by me at this point on this issue. You know, so tefillah would be very different for you than for me, maybe, or very different. You know, I might feel that, you know, what's best for me is maybe once a week. That, you know, really, oh, okay, maybe that is the best. I don't know. Okay, or maybe I should be daven like 4 hours a day. You know, because that's really, I can connect that way best. But unfortunately, that's not, human nature wasn't that way, and it took a little while. I don't know how long it took. I think it was the Ashkenazi Gedolah who actually formalized prayer. So it must have been a long time. You know, that means we had from Moshe Rabbeinu, which is what, 1400 BC, to the Ashkenazi Gedolah is almost 1,000 years. So we had a long period of time before there was structured prayer. There was prayer, there was always prayer, and there was a need for prayer. But everyone was on their own, you know, and maybe asking their rabbi, you know, what should I focus on, what should I say? There was no speech, there was no frequency, nothing. So the Ashkenazi Gedolah came and said, this is prayer from now on. Okay, this is how you often need to do it. And they have they used little hints in the Torah as parallels. You know, for example, you know, we say, Kel HaGadol HaGibor VeHamira, right? That actually comes from something Moshe Rabbeinu said. Right? So there's like examples in there. You'll see that several times. Different brachas come from different parts of what the Torah says, and what we understand of our relationship with the Kaddish Baruch Hu. But in nowhere does it say, this is what you should enact in the prayer service. Okay. So we mentioned also finally, you know, where these came from, and a lot of them came from the Ashkenazi Gedolah. Okay. Interesting. After all is said and done, and recognizing that the rabbis, for both gezeiros and for takanos, definitely have the best interests of the Jewish, you know, person in mind. Gezeiros because, watch out, you're going to slip. Takanos because I need structure. in my life, and left to my own device, perhaps I'm not using objective guidelines to come up to the answer of what I need to do. Maybe I'm using something else, like what I feel like doing right now. Okay, so even with that in mind, there was a one-year trial period for Tikkanas to see if Klal Yisrael accepts it.
Interesting.
Okay, and I'll give you one example. There are many. Before the destruction of the Second Temple, the Jews were leaving. You know, it wasn't like a gullus in the sense that, you know, in Babel, they went in two big sweeps. The first sweep happened about, I think 7 years or six, you know? 7 years, I think, before the ultimate destruction of the temple and the expulsion. That was when Jeremiah went, that's when the king went. And some of the leaders went. It actually was a good thing. Kadosh Baruch Hu had Rachmanis and the Jewish people because they went and they created the yeshivas that when the masses went 7 years later, there was already an infrastructure, Jewish infrastructure there. But everyone else went at the same time. So it was like maybe 1%, 2%, and then 98%, and everyone, a trivial number were left. Okay, that wasn't the case in the second Gullus. There many, many people left as soon as they could. Well, before, when things were bad. After Yerushalayim was encircled, they couldn't leave. So, and then when Yerushalayim was destroyed, the people who didn't die, most of them went to different parts of Israel. Beitar was destroyed 60 years later. Yavne was the seat of government for many years, another 100 years perhaps. So people were still around, and the dispersion happened really in several waves. But when the rabbis saw that people were going, and they weren't going just to Babel, they were going everywhere. There's records, for example, of Jews in Spain from way back, way before the 700s. Greece, Italy, Egypt. So they were everywhere. The rabbis were concerned that there would be a lot of, you know, interplay, interactions between Jews and non-Jews. And that in itself was not what's disconcerting. What they were worried about was that that would lead to intermarriage itself. So they made several takanas at this point, some of which we live with, most of these we live with today, and they all came from this issue. One is that no wine touched by non-Jew could be drank by a Jew.
I'm sorry, several takanas were made after the destruction of the Second Temple?
Yes. Okay. I'm not sure if exactly they came at that point, shortly before or shortly after, but at that time. As they say in yeshiva, that tekufa. You say a word when it means, you know, exactly. Tekufa is period, literally. Okay, but it means, I don't know about when it was, so I'll use that. That phrase kind of covers me on all bases. Right, so you know about wine, non-mavushal, that kind of stuff. That's where it came from. All right, it wasn't an issue beforehand, it became an issue then. No food cooked by a non-Jew, unless a Jew had something to do with the cooking process. That's Bishalakum. That came from that point. Okay? And one other one they made is no bread. You couldn't have bread that was made by a non-Jew. And there were others. Wine, I said, shemen, a bunch of other things. But of these that I mentioned, the Jews did not accept, could not accept the bread issue. It was just too difficult in some parts where not every small community had a Jewish baker. Okay? And it was much cheaper and much easier to just, you know, hire a non-Jew and say, listen, you're a baker. You can very easily have kosher bread and we'll buy it from you. All I got to do is check up on you once every month or two. You find someone who's reliable and it's not that easy to do. It's not, you know, most bread is probably kosher, but we never, you know, they're not interested in our business. We're not interested in it. It's okay. But it doesn't take much to have kosher bread. Most things don't have shortening in it, so you know, it's probably okay. All right? So that was never accepted as halacha. Because of that, even though it was a takana, okay. So that's an example of when the rabbis made a takana that never became mainstream halacha. This is the famous one, by the way, where we accept this during the Aseret Yemei Teshuva to show Hashem how much we love Him and how much we want to go for it. You know, the whole shmooze there that goes along with this. This is the not Bishalakum, that we still hold Pasakum, Paspalter. Paspalter is general pas, normal, regular. You heard of that?
You asked me.
Okay. Part of the takana. It's okay. Part of the takana was thou shall not eat bread baked by a non-Jew. Kosher bread. Okay? over the next year, it was clear that the Jews were not going to accept that. So it never became halacha lemaisa. It never became accepted halacha. Okay. Period. End of really discussion. Some Jews take it upon themselves to only eat pas Yisrael, bread made by Jews. That's a chumra. Okay? Yeah, that's an acceptable chumra. That means it's a stringency that one accepts upon themselves. You know, I need something more. We'll talk about that actually, I think next week. I need something more. My neshama needs something more. I think in this area, some people do this. For example, they have taivas in eating, so they'll look for chumras in eating. Right? The people do this. This is what people do. They know what their taivas are in, so they'll look for a chumra in that area. That's beyond halacha. You know, it's consistent with halacha, but it's the next step. So this is a chumra. It's a good chumra, if you're looking for chumras, because actually it was actually made as a takana anyway. It's not accepted as halacha lemaisa because the Jews didn't accept it, period. All right, that's the only reason. During the Aseres Yimei Tshuva, during the times between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the minhag, which we'll talk about next week, the minhag has been that we accept upon ourselves this stringency as a nation. Right? It's like an extra step, you know, beyond, above and beyond halacha lemaisa. And this is called pas Yisrael. Pas Yisrael, it means pas or dough or bread, really, made by only Jews, Shomer Shabbos Jews, and pas palter means bread made by anything else, general non-labeled bread, kosher, but non-labeled bread. Okay, so in summary, rabbinic. Okay.
How come we don't call it pat akum?
Yeah, because the thing is only because it'd be confusing with bishul akum. Because bishul akum would be confusing. Why wouldn't it be pas akum, right?
Why wouldn't pas halter be bishul akum?
I don't know. I mean, this is confusing to
me
too.
Sort of
it, yeah. It has confused me every year. I have to look into this because of that. So I might as well try to
write it down this time.
Yeah. Okay. 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 Thanks. I'll look up for it. All right. So in summary, there are rabbinical laws, and they are indeed part of the science. The science is. It's part of the soul's needs, but not the soul's needs per se. Meaning, we don't need, as I used the example before, or another example. Our soul does not need specifically to go hear the Megillah, okay? Because hearing the Megillah is a rabbinical law, and God created our souls, right? But God told us, "You shall not sway from the, you shall not stray from their words, left or right." That's what our soul needs. So our soul needs the existence of the Gezeirah so we have a greater appreciation, respect. And a concern, I guess, of breaking the Hashem's Torah, number one. And number two, the Takana. Our souls needs the structure that comes with Takana, because left up to their own devices, sometimes we don't choose and we don't select the best way to lead ourselves when the halacha, the Torah, the halacha, was left rather vague. So the Takana comes and fills in the structure. The Gezerah gives us fences so as we have protective barriers. Okay? Next week, we'll meet, and then we'll talk about custom. And I can daven more again. Okay? All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I do appreciate you coming.
So great. I've been wanting a class on this. I'm so glad.
Oh, yes. I do have handouts here. I wanted